The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
WAC, Art and the Feminist Revolution. The next in our series of interviews with women whose work appears in the exhibition. WAC is on view at PS1 from February 17th to May 12th, 2008. PS1 also presents a special series of performances and panels featuring WAC artists and other women influenced by the feminist movement.
What a temper you are in. Told them once, told them twice, not listened to advice. I took a kettle of lard.
This is David Weinstein for Art Radio WPS1.org. Continuing our series of interviews with artists that have participated or will participate in the WAC show at PS1. WAC is Art of the Feminist Revolution. And I am joined today by the artist, composer, educator, author, philosopher, Pauline Oliveros. Welcome to the Clock Tower Studios.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
So we can add to that list or junk it. Or junk it as we go along. The first thing I would like to know is, what do you have in WAC, and how did you get yourself involved in WAC? And then we'll backtrack from there.
Okay. Well, WAC contacted me and wanted to put in something from my sonic meditations, which were, you know, a body of work that I did in that time, in the 70s. And perhaps they also used To Valerie Solanas and Marilyn Monroe in recognition of their desperation, which is the score that I did in 1970.
Well, Valerie Solanas.
Solanas was very important because she wrote the Scum Manifesto, and in the Scum Manifesto are the principles of feminism, a community that she detailed, and which I used as the basis for this piece, To Valerie Solanas and Marilyn Monroe in recognition of their desperation. And the piece is structured in such a way that everyone has a non-hierarchical role. So every part for the piece is the same, but the individual makes the differentiation, during the course of the piece. And but the community that is created in the piece absorbs any kind of too outstanding action, you know, so they get returned to the collective in the piece. Yeah, so structurally it's a feminist piece, but for someone to recognize that, they would have to, you know, study a little bit and read the Scum Manifesto maybe. Yeah. And they also were interested in an ensemble that I had. It was the women's ensemble. The title of the ensemble was impossible to say because we used the symbol for the female symbol to name the ensemble.
So it was the symbol, the circle with the
plus across. That's the ensemble, and it was an ensemble of about five or six women that I met with weekly at my home in Leucadia, California, and we would gather on every Tuesday night, say, and then practice, do a variety of practices that were kind of far out for that time, but would seem very normal these days.
When was it exactly?
It was about 1970, 71, right in that time.
And who was in the group?
Well, there was Lynn Barron, Lynn Lanadier, Lynn Betty and Shirley Wong, Bonnie Barnett, who is a radio personality these days.
Exactly.
Christine, I can't think of her last name at the moment. She was a vocalist.
We'll find it out.
We'll find it out. It's in the brochure.
You could look
anyways.
It up. It's in the brochure. Yeah. So what did you do?
Well, we would. First of all, this was a kind of an improvisation ensemble. We would improvise music together, but the kind of exploratory work we were doing would be to meet together and be nonverbal for most of the evening. We would do various kinds of physical exercises, energy exercises, I would say, and then we would share dreams, and from our dream journals, which we kept, and we would then do one of my sonic meditations that I started composing in 1970, and I we would do them with this ensemble of six. So I built up a kind of a body of work through that, but the exercises that we were doing were kind of regenerative. It seemed to help us a lot in terms of, there were relaxation exercises and some massage and so on, until we, you know, would go through the evening, and then we would share from our journals some items. And then that was it. Everybody would leave and go home for another week and come back and get regenerated again.
Was the sonic part of it?
It was vocal.
It was vocal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just used our voices.
And in those days, you were yourself trained to play other instruments?
Well, I played the accordion, and I also played the horn. I was also very, very involved in electronic music since the end of the 50s. So I was, at the time, a professor at University of California, San Diego, in the music department. I had been brought there to establish the electronic music program for the graduate students.
So this is when you were in San Diego that you had the first group?
Yes.
With the symbol, the woman symbol?
That's right, yes.
And so, okay, so that's interesting because, well, you already have established a path and gone off it. Well, I don't know if off it, but if anybody who was watching you would have been already surprised at least once.
So, yeah, for sure.
But I am curious to know some of the stuff that led you through the 50s and 60s because the early electronic stuff is extraordinary. Maybe you can point out a couple of your highlights from that period and tell us where you were working and making those pieces, and then we'll go forward from there.
Sure. Well, you know, I actually started my electronic music with a kind of a home studio. Even though my friend and colleague Ramon Sender was kind of building a patching together a studio at the San Francisco Conservatory in 1959, and I had a Sears Roebuck tape recorder.
Fantastic. Nobody had a home studio in 1959.
Yeah, but I did. the core of it was the Sears Roebuck tape recorder. And it was an interesting tape machine because, it recorded at 3 3/4 and also 7 1/2, but I could hand-wind the tape in record mode, so I could do variable speed by hand. And I didn't have any other kind of electronic devices, so What I did, I used cardboard tubes with microphones to filter sounds, and I would use bathtub for reverberation, and I put small objects that vibrated on either on an apple box or on the wall to amplify them a bit, and record them in these various ways. And so that's how I made my first tape piece, which was called Time Perspectives, and it was a 4-channel piece, even though there wasn't any 4-channel. You know, you start with bigger dreams, right? And actually, Ramon and I synchronized the tapes by unwinding them and using the long halls at the conservatory to line them up.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So it was... That's the home studio of 59, 60.
So some things from this period, well, most of them were, if they were released, they were on vinyl and they went out of issue, but some things have been re-released.
Well, yes. I mean, there are several pieces that are kind of fairly well known, like Bye Bye Butterfly and One of Four, Big Mother is Watching You. these pieces are out in the world. I mean, the first one was one of four. That came out on an Odyssey vinyl that David Behrman produced in 1966, I think, 67. And Bye Bye Butterfly came out on Arch record that Charles Amokanian produced in 1970. And then Big Mother is Watching You didn't come out until later. And also Al Margolis produced Beautiful Soup and Nomo on his Pogus label. So those pieces are out there.
Yeah, I just want to give people a little idea of where they can go to find the early.
Right. Yes, still. But what's coming up? I'll mention that because important music, the important label is doing lots of reissues, and they've reissued a couple of my albums from the '80s. One is the Pauline Oliveros Accordion and Voice, and the other is The Wanderer, which has a piece on there for 22 accordions, but. He is preparing to release a box set of all my 60s electronic music that's never been released at all. So it won't be a reissue, but finally an issue.
The kids are going to come looking for you.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
They will.
Yeah, there's some sounds on there that they might like to know about.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's great to know. Okay, so there's a couple of things that people remember from the sort of keywords. It's the San Francisco Tape Music Center. Is that
yes,
which is wonderful. I mean, anachronistic type of title to think today. And the whole concept of tape music,
well,
and the old days when we used to put the speakers out there and put a spotlight on each speaker and turn out all the lights. And,
right, yeah. Good old days.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. So that project became
The Mills Tape Music Center.
Right,
it was moved from San Francisco to Mills College, and still exists today as the Center for Contemporary Music, and hundreds of composers have gone through there, and it's still a wonderful place. But one thing to mention also is that there will be a book coming soon from the University of California Press called The San Francisco Tape Music Center: The Counterculture. And it's edited by David Bernstein. But it has articles, essays, documentation, everything that we didn't have in the days that we were doing it is in this book. And it's accompanied by a DVD, which has recreations of some of the pieces we did in the 60s and then also some that we are doing now. This is a project of IMPACT, the Experimental Media and Performing Arts Center at RPI, where I teach these days.
Mm-hmm. RPI is
Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute.
Right. Yeah.
Soon to be known as Rensselaer, and then to be known as Rensselaer University.
So we start out, you're in San Francisco, then comes Mills.
Yeah.
Where you were for some years.
1 year.
1 year.
I was the director of the Mills Tape Music Center, 66, 67.
Okay.
Then San Diego hired me, the University of California.
And there you were for some years.
14 in San Diego, and then I made a wild leap into the void and ended up in upstate New York.
Did you come straight from California to upstate?
Yes, I did.
You did have a place in the city?
For a couple of years, yes.
Because I met you at the University of Illinois when you came and did a presentation. I think you might remember the famous Sal Martirano
event. Absolutely.
Wonderful man.
Yeah.
Basically, you came there and you didn't make a piece. You didn't show a piece to us, but you discussed.
Oh, I see. And that was the day of the brunettes.
Yes, the day of the brunettes. So Herbert Brun and his students would sort of face off with the kind of wild post hippie young experimenters, and then you got caught in the middle because all you wanted to do was talk about your work, or maybe more than just talk about it. But anyway. This would be 75, 76-ish.
I think so. Yeah.
And so this would be the period where you. I'm trying to remember the piece that you were describing. They were sort of ritualistic.
I can tell you what it was. It was Rose Moon. Rose Moon was a ceremonial piece, and it was in cycles.
That's right. It was a long piece.
A very long piece. It was done with Neely Bruce and Phyllis, Neely and Phyllis Bruce at Wesleyan, Connecticut Wesleyan, Wesleyan University, and it involved. Well, it was. It had a black and white very narrow circular tent in the center. And then Neely and Phyllis were inside of that tent, nude. And outside of the tent, there were four dancers who were representing, I think, the directions, and you know, north, south, east, west, and had very kind of ritualistic motions that they were doing. And around the there was then a pathway for a procession that went around the tent, and then there was a seated circle of performers, and a runner that circumambulated the whole thing, and the runner had sounding jingles and things on her, and as she passed the seated performers, they were supposed to sense when she passed and respond as instantaneously as they could with the sound. So the runner was, you know, kind of a rhythm control. Mm-hmm. And the procession, I forget exactly what the instructions were now because it's been a long time, but there were chantings of the names of the moon, and a variety of ways of making sound. And so, and the leader of the procession had a moon rattle. It was a papier-mâché moon that, of course, had seeds inside. And so it would be shaken as the procession moved. And then there would, at the end of each cycle, there would be a lot of rowdy stuff happening. Like kind of celebration like thing. Yeah. Anyways, it was really fun to do. The very important were the three lunatics.
Remember this.
Yes, the lunatics would, you know, attack anybody and try to distract them and ruin their meditation any way they could. I almost was undone myself because Linda Montano was one of the lunatics, and she was dressed in a fur coat, and she was carrying a typewriter with a piece of paper in it. And she would come up. She came up to me and was talking about her term paper and how she was trying to do this, you know, write this paper. And oh my God, it was so funny.
One interesting thing about this is that you were placed in a completely distinct locale on this continuum between the battles of various composer and music camps at that point. There was a very distinct battle that was brewing 75, 76 between, in Illinois, there were this sort of hardcore serialists.
Yeah.
And that bled into everything, the electronic studios, the ensemble writing, the theorists and everything. And then there was this emerging, at first called the minimalists, but it was definitely people who, with Steve Reich and Phil Glass, would say that they accepted what was considered sort of pop music or popular music. So there was the low art, high art thing, and the serialists were riding the high, saying they were taking the high road, and the new sort of minimalists were taking this, you know, merging of, you know, using an electric guitar, and your piece was, you know, mm-hmm. somehow a rule breaker. But then there's you. And it's really like a third path. Where do you think how you got there as opposed to being in either of those other two places?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly when I went to UCSD and accepted that position, it had quite an impact for me because I had a struggle speaking of binaries and oppositions, with joining what was the establishment to me, because I'd been an artist out on my own for 15 years. And the first paycheck I ever saw was when I was the director of Mills Tape Music Center for that 1 year, and that was only a half-time position. So when I got to UCSD and I was hired as a lecturer because I didn't have an MA or a PhD, but I had 15 years of experience that nobody else had, you know, and they wanted to have electronic music, and so I was. And I struggled because I had left an MA program because it didn't feel like it was helping me with my composition, with what I wanted to do. And so here I was going into this establishment institution, which claimed to be creating a music department where composers could be comfortable. And I was one of the composers that they wanted to have there. So if I could be comfortable there, well then maybe it would be okay. But I had this struggle in accepting the position. Was I selling out on my ideals? You know, I mean, the San Francisco Tape Music Center didn't exist as it had because it had moved into an establishment organization, Mills College. And then here was another organization opening its doors, so to speak. And in the end, I accepted the position. My mentor was there, Robert Erickson, whom I had studied composition with. And it seemed as though there were going to be interesting people. And so I went in through that door of opportunity, which it was. So I accepted the position, and I established the music program, electronic music program. And within a couple of years, you know, this was during the Vietnam War, and one of the students at UCSD immolated himself on the plaza at UCSD. And then there was the assassination of Robert Kennedy while I was watching television. This happened. And so I began to, you know, become very introspective in reflecting on what was happening and the work I was doing, how did it play into what was needed in society at this time? And so I began to really, you know, listen. I would sit and sing long tones and listen to feel what effect it had on my body and my mind. And so I found a way of meditation, actually, through sound, but it was my own. It wasn't motivated by some traditional practice, because in those days, although there were practitioners around, Zen practice and yoga and so on, they were not. They were really peripheral and kind of marginal.
It's funny because people now would not imagine that.
No, not at all. Yeah. No, it seems like, you know, everything.
Every corner has a yoga.
Everything is available. There's a spiritual supermarket on your yeah. next corner, but there wasn't that at the time, and so I was finding my own way through sound, which is what is the anchor in my life is sound and listening, and. So then I began to work with this group of women because I was also having the sensibility that women were not being treated very well. pretty obvious, but at the time, the women's movement was just beginning to emerge in the 70s, early 70s. So the work that I was doing with these women was really right on the wave of what was happening. And I started creating these sonic meditations, as I mentioned. And I started to use them in a very large class at the university called The Nature of Music, which had 150 students signed up for, and they weren't musicians. They were the general students, and these meditations I could use with them and have them have a rather powerful experience with sound, even though they weren't trained in music at all. And this, I thought, was important, and that was, you know, kind of what it was opening up for me was the social consciousness and the how you can impact socially with your work and to make pieces which were still satisfying to me in terms of where I came from. I was involved with postmodern and experimental music, and but no matter how you look at it, I was always in the margin. And I've always felt that marginality. In fact, my next book will be called Sounding the Margins. Anyway, that's how I got started in doing things that my colleagues were scratching their heads. They didn't know what the heck I was doing with these sonic meditations. You know, I mean, and these were instruction pieces. They weren't conventionally notated and so on. It was something very different. And so that's how it happened.
That sets the stage nicely for what then unfolds over the next years. Mm-hmm. Here's another little thing that I noticed about you. You came to New York, which I do remember being shocked by this.
Mm-hmm. That shocked a lot of people.
Another thing that didn't happen in those days was people didn't go jump coasts. Mm-hmm. You know, you picked your coast and you pretty much sat there. It really was like that. And the people on the East Coast particularly didn't think that the Californians were going to come east. I mean, a lot of New Yorkers would get burned out and fed up and go retire in California, but nobody went. So this was a fantastic thing. I also remember you had a business card. I think it was a business card. Pauline Oliveros, independent composer. This is another model that you broke. In those days, you were in the university and you went common practice and you headed on a straight path to Lincoln Center or to Broadway, or you started a rock band. But you basically, there, that low-high thing was still pulling, but you were considered impure if you didn't just suffer. When you put out a card that said, Pauline Oliveros, independent composer, I think it blew people's minds. Because now you were sort of like, you were in business as a composer.
Right.
And that was just not allowed. So tell me about that, because you remember, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, sure I do. I did. I mean, it was very deliberate. Yeah. It wasn't something that I just tossed off. I mean, I was independent of the establishment at that point.
Because now you didn't have the San Francisco Tape Center. You didn't have Mills.
Didn't.
You didn't have...
No, I didn't have UCSD.
You didn't have UCSD anymore. You'd come to New York. You let it go.
So I was independent. And, you know, independence was an important term, I think, for me. You know, to be independent meant that I was free to do whatever I could do. And I know what I did was I made also a postcard. I don't know if you ever saw the postcard, but I had a picture of me on the postcard playing my accordion sitting in my garden in California, actually. And on it I said that I was, what did I say? It gave a list of things that I would do, you know, lectures, workshop. First it was composition, performance, lectures, workshops, and I gave my contact information. That's all I did. And I sent it out, you know, to my contact list, basically. And, I mean, that was a mailed-out postcard. That was before we had internet, way before. And so the independent composer put out a postcard, and then I just waited and, let things happen. And do you know that, so I had left the university. I had left a tenured senior position to do this, and... I made more money in the 80s than I did in the university.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, that's true. And it was simply through engagements. And I mean, I knew I would have to perform. And in the university, I was hired as a composer, so I wasn't expected to perform. In fact, sort of discouraged from it in a way.
That's another another model that was changing over these decades.
That's right.
The composer slash performer was a new thing.
That's right. And so, so I did perform. Begin to perform a lot, and you know, I was invited to a lot of different places. Just as a result of having sent that postcard out, and then people knew I was around, and so the phone would ring.
It was the way to make a living.
That was it.
Performing was the way. Even in those days, records didn't really. You could lose your savings making a record. It might work as a good marketing tool, but you had to get out and do the performances.
You did.
This was another model that you adjusted for yourself and for the world, because I remember thinking, oh, my God, Pauline Oliveros is actually going to go on stage. You know, we're going to see her live. That was actually a little mind shift there, mm-hmm. because the great composers didn't get up and you know.
And do that.
Yeah, touching the notes themselves, which is kind of fantastic. Another fantastic thing to remember. Just the model changed.
Yeah.
It's a paradigm shift.
Yeah, so it was.
So, and I don't know. Okay, you made some money. Maybe that led to some resentment. I don't know.
Resentment?
From people who, you know, were either trapped in the university
were
running around wishing that they could sell their music.
Yeah, right. I know that there were so many people who, when they found out I was leaving, you know, would break into such a big smile. It was very funny. It was like, oh, I wish I could do that.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, oh, you're going to get spanked.
No, I don't think so. You know, I think it was exciting. I think that people have a lot of dreams of, you know, doing other than what they're doing. And which leads me to advise people to do what they want to do, because that's what I did. I did what I want. I said, do what you want to do until somebody pays you for it. But today, I mean, I really think it's awful. I see people chasing after job descriptions, you know, trying to fit themselves into job descriptions which don't fit them. And so I've been advising my students not to do that.
So this, again, now sets the stage for the next years because up to now, because what you formulated, and now we'll go into the deep listening portion of the program, deep listening with capital DL, because you have now Deep Listening Band, you have the Deep Listening Institute, and then there's sort of a whole, I don't know if it's a lifestyle, it's a philosophy and a healing and listening process that you teach and share.
Deep listening is now a meme, and I have a Google alert on deep listening, and so every day I get a list of Google alerts of how deep listening is being used throughout the world. And I mean, it's really kind of interesting, because when I coined it in 1988, you didn't hear that. You didn't see mm-hmm. those two words together that I know of. I never came across it anywhere. I did know about deep ecology, which was that movement of deep ecology. And so deep listening came about because Stuart Dempster and I and Paniotis went down into the cistern in Washington State and made a recording in the cistern, which had a 45-second reverberation time. So when you play a sound, it would be hanging around there for 45 seconds. And so you didn't make mistakes because you don't want to hear a mistake for 45 seconds following. But in any case, it was a way of listening and performing and considering, experiencing a space as a performer. I mean, the space as part of the instrument. And that's what we were doing in there. And there's a recording called Deep Listening. We named it Deep Listening, and then we named the Deep Listening Band. I wrote a little essay in the liner notes, which kind of formulates the beginnings of that program. And so that recording is still floating around. It's a New Albion recording, and it's still in print and still happening after 20 years.
And it's you and Stuart Dempster.
Yes, Panayotis was involved in it as well, singing a bit.
And Stuart has been a principal player.
Colleague of mine. 50 years, more than 50 years now, but we did a 50-year celebration of musical friendship. But, Stuart is really wonderful and amazing, supportive colleague. So the Deep Listening Band now consists of Stuart, myself, and David Gamper, who was a student of mine at UCSD.
And he's in New York State now.
He lives in New York, yes, okay. And has his own thing called See Here Now with his wife, Gisela.
And Gamper played what in the...
He played piano,
right. And Stuart played trombone.
Trombone, didgeridoo.
And didgeridoo. And you were playing accordion at this point?
And then we have the expanded instrument system that we use as signature, because we were really interested in trying to recreate some of the acoustic environments that we play in, like the cistern. And so that's what we use the expanded instrument for, instrument system, to create different environments to perform in. And this next year, this year, we just had a happy new year, didn't we? This is 2008, and this is the 20th anniversary year of the Deep Listening Band.
There's a couple of things that you said that I reflect on a little bit. One is that the cistern is amazing, because any 45-second, if you think about this, 45-second reverb, and then you said the funny thing, well, you don't make a mistake if you know you're stuck with it for 45 seconds. But the truth is, as we learn, that you can't make a mistake in a room with a 45-second reverb. And I think if people want to begin to address what Pauline Oliveros, our guest, is talking about for the deep listening experience, or how to you yourself could begin to generate this kind of experience for yourself, that is something I think we all know, that like you holler, it hangs in the air, and you maybe think, oh, I hit a bad note, and then after about 20 seconds you're saying, man, that is the greatest thing I ever heard in my life. Do it again. So anyway, that's, I just wanted to underscore that. And the other thing is, you talked about, and I think you've said this for many years, do you say expanded instruments?
Expanded, yes.
Because while we're talking about you moving into accordion and the meditations and working with acoustic instruments in special acoustic spaces, you're the girl that had the home studio in 1959. You've continued to be pretty much cutting edge with your knowledge and use of electronics. Mm-hmm. And I remember that a couple of concerts where there is a bank of stuff, like a lot of very fancy or mysterious looking processors, and some maybe bought off the shelf, but maybe not, I don't know, but address that a little bit, because you have not let go of that. You're sharp on this subject still.
This is true. Well, it's very simple. There's two things. One is that I play the accordion, which has these little metal reeds. They're called free reeds. Yeah, and free reed instruments include accordions, bandoneons, harmonicas, concertinas, harmoniums, anything, and all the Asian mouth organs have this free reed. And this free reed that vibrates inside of a sounding chamber is, at least 4,000 years old. It's an old idea, but that it has continued for 4,000 years. And so that, I think, is pretty important. Mm. The other idea is that when you make a sound, it has to reverberate back to you. I mean, I'm hearing my voice come back in there's a little bit of delay, a little reverberation, a little lag time. And when I worked with my tape recorder, I noticed the difference between hearing if you were listening off of the record head, or if you're listening off the playback head, or if you're listening off of both, you hear the delay between those two heads, right? So that was my free read. It was the delay that excited me. And the tape recorder was my electronic instrument of those days. And so I worked with delay. And I worked with that, noticing that if you, for instance, I did a piece for Anna Halperin, her dancer's workshop, where I had several tape recorders. And the sounds, whatever sounds that were being made by the dancers I was recording, selectively playing back during the course of the performance what they had already sounded inadvertently. These were not conscious or intentional sounds that they were making. It was just the sounds that happened, and I would accumulated these sounds, and I would be playing back and so forth. But I was also very gradually opening the distance. I mean, opening the playback recording head and playback head, so that delay was very gradually introduced, until finally you had this expanded space that came from the reverberation that was made by the tape recorders, and then this layering and accumulation of sounds, because the sounds that were played back into the space got recorded back again too, and so by the end of the piece you had this huge monumental space and layered sound. So that was the beginning of what I call expanded instrument system, and it's expanded because of your expanding time. You have what happens in what you think of as the present, and it has the potential, what's going to happen in the future. When it does happen, when it's played back at a delayed time, it's then part of the past. And that's what I mean by expansion or expanded. It's expanded time-space or space-time. And so I've used that idea, that simple idea, to this day, to make this music and to make this system. And the processors that you referred to were Lexicon PCM42 delay processors, and I got those in 1983, one for each hand. And that kind of replaced having to carry around huge tape recorders to do this work. So that was a shift. I mean, you know, from an analog heavy device to a part analog, part digital device, and then finally in the 90s, shifting the whole thing to computer. So, and that was hard to do because, you know, the warm sound of magnetic tape is one thing, and then the Lexicon had the best sound of that combined digital with analog, but it still was part analog. And then finally with the computer, it just took a long time before you could get sound quality with enough bits that you could accept it. And I still find that it's very different.
And yet, but you did make the change.
I did. I made the change.
And once again, she makes the change.
Yeah, once again.
Yeah. There's courage in all these changes, I think. And there's a lot of people that, you know, there's all these pure... It seems to be you against the purists in every case. Or not against. I don't know why I keep making it like... But, you know, it's like you're... There's a certain sort of like orthodoxy to some of these worlds that we find ourselves in, and you seem to be able to sort of step back and, you know, say, well, the right choice is here, and that's where I'm... You know, for me, and that's where I'm going. Yeah.
Well, it really is about how it sounds, you know. That's the guide, and that's the listening part. I'm listening, you know, for what it is that I need and want to do.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the listening to sound and music has been, you know, the core of my life. So that's where my religion is, is listening.
It's here. So, two last thoughts. One is, let's talk about the Deep Listening Institute and sort of give people a general idea of, well, we should tell them how to find it. There's a website, of course.
Mm-hmm. www.deeplistening.org.
And it operates out of Kingston?
Yeah, Kingston is our home base, but it operates internationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a lot of, there's different components to this thing. I mean, it's...
I'll say.
Yeah, and I was poking around on the site today and also, and there's quite a lot going on. You do a lot of community things.
Yes.
You're involved with kids.
Yeah.
Talk about a couple of those things that are close to you.
Okay, well, I'll talk about a couple of things if I can. I mean, there's so many. But one of our main projects at the moment is called Adaptive Use Musical Instruments for the Physically Challenged. We're working with three children at the moment who have cerebral palsy, and I asked my friend Leif Miller, who is an occupational therapist and musician whom I've known for 20 years and who works at the rehab school, Rehab Programs Inc., North Road School in Poughkeepsie. She and I had been talking for years about how could we help some of these children who really have severe limitation in terms of movement to make music. Because she has a drum class that she does at the school, and she gets everybody involved, even people who you think couldn't be involved. So we went to, I got a grant and organized a team of researchers from Rensselaer to help think about this. And we went and observed these three children. The three children are confined to wheelchairs, have no voluntary movement except maybe head movement, and can't speak. So this is pretty severe. And the technology that they had in use there was mechanical switch, which could be triggered. You know, you could trip the switch and it would trigger something. So when we observed this, we realized we could really help a lot. And we made one of my undergraduates at Rensselaer came back with a camera tracker, so that it was a program on the computer where the student could sit in front of the computer and there would be an image there from the camera that's built into the computer. And then with the program, you could put a marker, say, on the tip of the nose. And then there would be a vertical line if you went on either side of the line. Just with a little head movement, you could have a digital switch, and it could be programmed to anything. Hmm. And in this case, he programmed it to a snare drum. So you heard the snare drum sound if you moved either way. And then he made a virtual keyboard, so you could move along the keyboard and play melodies. So these three children, on the very first time they tried it, all three got it just swiftly as you want to think of, and could play melodies for the first time ever. It was very, very exciting and very moving. And the upshot of that is that the older girl began to be able to improvise drum patterns. And her teacher, Leif, would play a pattern, and then she would answer. You can instantly see, you know, the benefit and the delight and the empowerment, because improvisation is empowerment, you know, to be able to move and respond, at least sound-wise, is a very, very powerful thing for these kids. So that's one thing we're doing, and we're continuing with it, and we have many, many ways to go with it.
Yeah, that's an endless.
Yeah, it's so much.
Interfaces are.
There's so much need. Well, interface is the very core issue. You know, how do you access the power of that device, the computer? You know, I mean, where there's you know, so much power to and so many powerful things that could happen with it if only you can interface yeah. with it, no matter what. But it's the same is true if, as one human to another. How do you interact and interface with one another?
I can't dispute the comparison. I have that problem every day.
Right. So that's one project.
And that's one of many but the aspects of Deep Listening Institute,
yes,
which is deeplistening.org.
Yes, but I should talk just tell that I mean, the more you talked about my being on the cutting edge, and I'm still there because of the research that I've been doing the last 18 years has to do with telematic music transmission, which means transmitting music over distance, and most to just leap right to the front end here is doing multi-site concerts with CD quality audio in 8 channels and DV quality video. This is a very important thing. So you can find it on the site by going to the telematic music. It's on the front page. And
this is something, just to clarify for people, this is something where, well, I'm going to say musicians, but maybe not, it's not necessarily musicians, but performers and musicians in different parts, literally, of the world, connected by the internet, mm-hmm. see and hear each other,
right.
and in real time,
yeah.
collaborate, improvise,
right.
exactly. make something together.
Exactly.
And those are those people selected by you or by?
Well, currently, there's two things. There's a high tech and then there's low tech. And at the Deep Listening Institute, we had a project called the Deep Listening Convergence, with 45 musicians interacting with one another through a voice over internet application called Skype. And these musicians were in Switzerland, Canada, across the United States, and they met together in various configurations to create new ensembles and to improvise and to plan new pieces. And this was this Deep Listening Convergence, which is on the site, was a 5-month residency. With people calling and hosting and doing this, and at the end of it in June, all of the musicians came together in upstate New York, physically together, to present 4 concerts, and these concerts were all shaped, and the music was rehearsed in the virtual mm-hmm. residency. And when they came together, there was really no time to do rehearsals. We were going out and doing sound checks at you know, 4 different venues. And there were 25 new pieces premiered in these 4 concerts. And the concerts were fantastic. It was an amazing experience having everybody come together, and the excitement and mm-hmm. interest there was in the gathering, you know, in
so the
physical space.
Some of them maybe never had met.
No, that's true. Some of them had not. What I need to say is that most of the majority of these musicians were musicians who had completed a 3-year training in the Deep Listening retreats, and so they had their certificates. And are you know, certified to teach deep listening mm-hmm. as it's taught in the retreats. But they're wonderful musicians, many, all kinds. and it was just fantastic the way it came together. But the other high tech end is done at Rensselaer. The partners have been Stanford, which we've been weekly transmitting with for a year and a half, at Karma, the Computer Music Center, and this fall where we were joined by UCSD. Mm-hmm. And you probably know Mark Dresser.
Mm-hmm.
Mark is at UCSD teaching there, so he's been involved with it, and Sarah Weaver, who's sitting here with us in the studio, was very involved with this whole project. and she's involved with the deep listening.
This seems to be the lion's share of your attention right now for the coming...
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm just about to make another leap, which is to go to France and be at the Camargo Foundation in residence for 4 months. And so my connection with Rensselaer and with Deep Listening Institute will be telematic.
Yes.
From France.
So any other kind of curiosities that you're eager to get your hands on in the next, down the next road other than...
Yeah, a beach towel so I can sit there on the sand in the Mediterranean.
No. Sounds good. That's fair. That's a fair answer. That's probably what I would say. I'm going to let you guys go. This has been a real pleasure.
Oh, I'd say.
This is David Weinstein with Pauline Oliveros, the composer, and as you've heard, many other things. Thank you for coming to the Clock Tower. We'll go on to deeplistening.org to follow your adventures.
Right. And PaulineOliveros.us.
Oh, there you go.
That's my own website.
We finish. This is David Weinstein for Art Radio WPS1.org.
Thank you, David.
WAC, Art and the Feminist Revolution. Our series of interviews with women whose work appears in the exhibition. WAC is on view at PS1 from February 17th to May 12th, 2008.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.